May is Mental Health Awareness Month. We discuss ways to turn awareness into action. From SDPB, today is Tuesday, May 20th. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, from the urgent response of 988 as represented by 13,000 sticky notes to the soothing sounds of crystal singing bowls, we look at ways South Dakotans are responding to crises, challenges, and the call to support mental health, wellness, and self-care. We'll begin with updates from Avera Behavioral Health as we ask, how are South Dakota's kids handling the stressors of daily life? We relax to Veronica Ludwig's Sound Baths. Plus, before we get to the slow days of summer, we need to say goodbye to school. Teacher Talk explores closure. That's coming later in the hour. We're broadcasting today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're In the Moment. News is first. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. We're going to start today's show with a number, 988. When you call or text that number, you will be connected with mental health specialists for you or for a loved one. It's an important number for an important topic. Again, it's 988. We are going to explore the mental health care landscape in the state now, and we'll begin with resources available for our kids. Dr. David Ermer is the Clinical Vice President of Behavioral Health at Avera. He sat down with me in SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls.
I do think we're doing a better job. We've lowered the stigma for mental health. We're identifying more people, and more people are being comfortable coming out talking about their mental illness. Yeah. Of course, that creates a problem, a good problem, in that we are identifying it, but we still don't have enough counselors and professionals helping deal with mental health. So I think part of the problem is scarcity of resources. And so we're identifying more people, but we need more people to help.
Yeah. Do you not have the workforce? Do you not have the people going through an educational pipeline, or not have the resources? Where are the gaps?
Yeah. So there's a gap in psychiatrists, because we, even if we graduated, filled every class of residency every year after medical school, we still wouldn't have enough people serving. So there is a pipeline issue. There's also an issue in South Dakota, just because in rural areas, there's just a scarcity of mental health professionals too. So I think it's a combination of placement of professionals, but also just not having enough being produced, so to speak.
Because the need is high, or because the recruitment is low?
The recruitment, actually, psychiatry is becoming a very popular residency, and I think part of it is because you do get to spend that time with patients, but we just don't, I think recruitment's good, but we just don't have enough spots to fill the gap.
Yeah. How are we serving rural South Dakotans?
There's a lot of innovative ways. You know, we always talk about the negative side of COVID, but one of the positives is we really had to switch to telemedicine, so I think we've really... More and more people got comfortable with telemedicine, which is we're able to reach people where they are. So we're bringing the services to them in rural. So that's helped. We also, like at Avera, we're starting a collaborative care model, which is basically creating efficiencies with psychiatrists. So if it's a model where we embed a behavioral health manager in the primary care clinics, and they create a registry of maybe 80 to 100 patients. And then once a week, they discuss those patients with a psychiatrist who makes recommendations. So in an hour, instead of seeing one or two people, I can cover 80 patients and create that efficiency. And that's what we need to do. We need to create programs that sort of are where we're supporting primary care, where they're the primary people, for a lot of good reasons. 60% of referrals from primary care never follow up with behavioral health. So people aren't coming in. There's a distance factor. There's still some stigma. So I think, again, capturing people where they are, they're more comfortable with it, and it's a good service. And studies have shown it's cost-effective. Patients are happy with it. Doctors are happy with it. And better outcomes.
Yeah. So one of the challenges is, it's sort of like if you're elbow hurts, and then the next day it doesn't, and then the third day it comes back, and then it's okay for a couple weeks, and then when it comes back, you might finally go to your doctor and say, hey, something's up with my elbow. With mental health, what's quote-unquote normal, you know, ups and downs? If I'm stressed, I'm feeling better. I'm stressed, I'm feeling better. And when do I say, hey, I think this is a problem, my elbow hurts now?
It's a great question. You know, our earlier textbooks in psychiatry have discussed, what is our goal in mental health? Is it to have like this, like, you know, reaching the highest level? I think it's, I think if emotional problems are starting to impact how you feel on a daily basis, in fact, your social life, your occupation, your relationships, your sleep, and how you're feeling, then it's a problem. And it's normal. We all should feel stress.
Yeah.
You know, and it's actually good. Weirdly, it's good to have a little bit of stress. Too much is terrible.
Where's that line between when you look at someone and say, maybe you need to remove from stress from your life, and when is it you need to work on handling the stress that's in your life?
That's why seeing a therapist can help. It may not be an easy decision, like this is when you have to do it, but going to see a counselor or a therapist who can help guide you, okay, tell me about your job, tell me where you see yourself, and just go, you know, kind of therapy and just discuss what's the best solution here. Maybe there's some coping strategies that can make your job more acceptable. Maybe it's being more assertive. Here's what we need to do. Maybe you need to go talk to your supervisor and say, these are things, I like working here, but these are things that need to change for me to feel good about working here. So there's lots of options. I always try to divide it into two things. We're talking about mental well-being, which is taking care of yourself, you know, removing yourself from stressful situations, spend time, real time with family and friends, not internet time.
Right.
Getting some exercise, eating well, sleeping well. Then there's mental illness, which is, you know, if you don't take care of yourself, it could lead to mental illness. But those are real diseases like depression, bipolar disorder, anxiety disorders. That's where you need treatment. But I think, so everybody needs to take care of their mental wellness. But, if it gets to the point of mental illness, then that's where you need the professional help.
Yeah. So let's talk about kids and COVID. We're 5 years on from the onset of a pandemic, and little kids and teenagers went through a lot. 5 years later, what are some of the things we're seeing show up as they still try to process that? Or they bounced right back?
They have not bounced right back. I think there's some resilient kids who did, but there's a lot of susceptible kids who still have some anxiety and mood symptoms. They kind of crushed our sense of security. All of a sudden, we thought, you know, we can take care of things. All of a sudden, the whole world shuts down, especially in some areas. And you think about as an adult, you know, 3 years of kind of relative isolation. We were a little bit probably better in South Dakota. Wasn't a big chunk of our life, but you take a second grader from, just think of the developmental milestones you have to achieve between second and fifth grade. For some kids, that whole period of time was isolated, and that has long-lasting effects.
Yeah. What are some of the ways that are still in our control to work on those long-lasting effects?
I think, again, introducing some optimism. You mentioned social media and media in general. I think, there was a physician program during COVID out of New York City because they were really struggling there, and it was out of Columbia University, and they had suggestions. These are the list of things physicians should do not to get burned out. Quit watching the news, get off the social media, take time, just get off those things. And I think for kids too, it's to helping them develop social relationships and healthy coping strategies.
Yeah. When you have an anxious kid, what are some of the things that you can do as a parent to help them process that anxiety, perhaps in partnership with a provider?
I think that supportive reassurance, you know, you don't want to be punitive. Oh yeah. You know, like, I can't believe, you know, be supportive. I understand that you're nervous about maybe trying a new sport, but I'll come with you and try to be supportive and even have those conversations, you know. And frankly, a lot of parents who have an anxious kid, you know, there's a huge genetic piece. They might even say, you know, I had the same kind of problems when I was your age, and these are some things we can do.
Yeah. And that, I was listening to an audiobook the other day, and this professional said she sees a lot of young adults, you know, and she might be their first encounter with a therapist. And she would say, like, you know, have you seen a therapist before? No, why not? Usual obstacles, you know, maybe there was, you know, resources or access. And then many of them say, well, my mom didn't want me to go because she was afraid that she would be blamed.
Yeah, that's always a fear of,
and,
you know.
And the therapist said, in fairness, there was a time when early in psychiatry where there was a lot of blaming the mother, right?
Oh, absolutely.
However, to the question, if parents are worried that basically I'm going to bring my kid to you and you're just going to tell me I'm a bad mom or I'm a messed up parent or it's my anxiety that is manifesting. I remember when I was pregnant, they were like, if you're anxious, your baby will be anxious.
Then you're
I was
more
like,
anxious.
Oh, thank you for that, right?
Right?
So that can be an obstacle too. How do you address parents when they're, you know, seeking help for their kids?
No, it goes back to the old refrigerator mother theory for autism. They thought cold, aloof mothers were causing their children's autism. It was a horrible, it's already tough to have a child, you know, with autism. But I think it's not looking backwards. It's forward thinking. It's that, okay, you know, what happened in the past is happened in the past. These are things you can do in therapy as a parent without pointing fingers or judging. Say, these are things we can do to help your child's anxiety. So a good therapist is going to say, you know, yeah, these things may have happened, but these are things we can do to help solve this problem. And I think that kind of approach is more problem solving, and it's going to not increase the parents' guilt. The parents have tons of guilt no matter what. Even
right, yeah.
There's a theory that from an old-time theory that talked about good enough parenting. And I think I tell parents this. I said, you know, we all make mistakes. You know, as long as you are good enough most of the time, your kids are going to do great and you're not going to be blamed for anything. It's good enough. You might make a mistake now and then. But I think that it's that sort of proactive thinking with parenting, not, hey, let's look back in the past and see the things you did wrong and why your kid's a problem. It's more like my child has anxiety, so these are some things you can do to help. And younger kids, parents are a big part of the solution, and that's the whole philosophy is you're a big part of the solution. Let's work together and help your child's anxiety.
So when you bring your kid to someone, are you in the room? Are you talking with them? Are you part? You know, here's my question. How do you involve a family in improvement?
Well, I think the younger the child, the more family involvement you have. I know initial value, maybe see a child and parent separately, but a lot of time the parent's there the whole time, especially for the younger child.
Okay.
And in fact, if you look at like kids with anxious predispositions, if you take like a 4 or 5 year old, they've had great studies showing you can leave the kid at home. And again, it's not blaming the parents. It's working with the parents. These are things you can do proactively to help make sure that the anxiety doesn't worsen.
Yeah. And do you see a lot of success?
Yes.
What does this look like when you find some of those tools in your toolkit?
Right.
And use them.
Exactly. You give parents appropriate tools to help deal with what's coming their direction, whether it be tantrums, irritability, or anxiety. And a lot of times you see great success.
Yeah. A kid's not going to come and say, I'm anxious.
No, I've never had a young person. To be honest with you, most kids and adolescents are there because their parents want them there, or the school does it. I've rarely had it.
Because of behavior?
Behaviors, you know, frankly, a fairly big manifestation of anxiety is irritability and outbursts because kids don't have the language skills to say, hey, I'm a little bit nervous about this situation. I'd rather take a break. Their emotions overwhelm them and they might have an outburst. And that's what the teachers and the parents see is this outburst. They don't realize the manifest cause of that is anxiety.
So is that a matter of medication? Is that a matter of, like, how much is, you know, you mentioned, you know, sleep and exercise and food, and then we also have this, you know, medication pathways, and then some cognitive, like, how are we thinking about
right.
these things and learning how to manage our emotions. I know it's different for everyone, but that would be, it strikes me, another obstacle that a parent might not want to bring their kid in because they don't want them to be medicated. Or an adult might say, I don't want any – that might be
right.
the thing that they don't want, even though they might eventually change their minds.
Right.
But that might keep them from going and asking for help.
No, and I always tell parents, I can't – you know, even if – let's say I diagnose anxiety and think of medicine, I'm not going to force that on you. I'll give – you know, these are a list of options. If you don't want medication, let's try therapy. Let's try these other things first.
Yeah. Right.
And, you know, I think a parent will never – say, hey, you've got to do this or else, especially with anxiety, because the studies have shown that therapeutic approaches can be just as effective in a lot of situations as medicines. It doesn't mean that I certainly don't try medicines at some point if we're not having success or if the anxiety is keeping them, like some kids are so anxious they can't even go to school, for instance, so we got to do something to overcome that.
Yeah. All right. Any other things that are coming up that are concerns as far as access that are on your radar that you're looking forward to?
No, I think the access is always an issue. I think it's a lot of it's driven by finances. We have people without health, and you know, if you don't have health insurance, it's hard to access any medical care or counseling because it's expensive. And a lot of the mental illnesses aren't a ear infection where you have 10 days of treatment and it's resolved. ADHD, a lot of times depression, anxiety can be a fairly long lasting thing. So it's a longer term treatment, more chronic.
That is David Ermer. He is the Clinical Vice President of Behavioral Health at Avera. You just heard Dr. David Ermer talk about mental health stigma throughout that interview. Earlier this month, SDPB's Jackson Dirks reported on an art installation that seeks to overcome that stigma. We're bringing you his story on 13,000 sticky notes of love, support, and encouragement.
Advocates say there's a stigma in South Dakota and across the nation about mental health. Mental health professionals and communities are trying to break that. They say one way is through expression and messaging. The South Dakota Department of Social Services, Helpline Center, and Lawrence and Schiller are trying one new approach to start the conversation in a more positive light: art.
There's 13,000 individuals that have contacted 988 in South Dakota alone, and this wall is a representation that if you are struggling, picking up that phone is the first step. It can be the hardest step, but you're not alone in what you're going through, and help is always here.
That's DSS Assistant Director Vanessa Barnes, who oversees the Office of Prevention and Crisis Services. She's standing in front of a wall with 13,000 sticky notes on it, each with a note of encouragement. Each note representing a story to tell of someone struggling, someone at their darkest moment, and someone in need of another person to talk to. But each also represents an opportunity and a message to those who need it. Messages like, you are needed. Focus on what you can control. And never be ashamed of who you are.
Sticky note is a powerful representation that help is always there. That you matter. It could be a sticky note on the door when you're leaving for the day that you matter and that things are going to be better. It's just that little positive affirmation that sometimes people need to keep going.
The notes are a part of a larger state initiative that Barnes's department is utilizing to reach everyone and break the stigma.
And stigma is preventing people from reaching out, having the hard conversation and mental health kind of being a taboo topic. This is part of our Notes to Self campaign through the Division of Behavioral Health, which is why we have all of the sticky notes. And so the Notes to Self campaign is really a campaign to destigmatize mental health and have that note to self that you matter and to reach out for help when you do need it.
The campaign launched 2 years ago and is trying to generate awareness around suicide prevention and make behavioral and mental health resources more widely available to all corners of the state. Barnes says she thinks one of the most powerful tools in preventing suicide is an educated community.
Making sure that individuals in the community are trained in the warning signs, the risk factors, how to communicate about suicide, how to reach out for help, what help is available, what resources are available in your community. So we offer free suicide prevention trainings for individuals to do just that. Because most of the time, it's the teachers, it's parents, it's loved ones, it's faith leaders that are seeing the individuals firsthand struggling. And so if we can equip them with the skills that they need to identify that somebody's struggling and the skills to communicate that and connect them to resources, we're really kind of strengthening that safety net.
May is Mental Health Awareness Month nationwide. That's why Chief Operating Officer with the Helpline Center, Amy Carter, says now seemed like the right time for the art piece.
It's a great time to just talk about this topic. So we are definitely hearing a lot of positivity, not only from people who are seeing the wall or talking about it, but those who have experienced it say this really helps them feel more confident in their journey. It helps them know that they aren't alone. It helps them feel like, you know, I can do this, I can get through this, and I can always reach out for help, and I'm not going to be judged for that. And so that's really our goal, is that people are never afraid to reach out for help and that they know those resources are out there.
Carter says for those in need, the first step she suggests is reaching out to 988 because it can connect people 24 hours a day to resources in South Dakota.
So, and it's such an easy number to remember, and it's so accessible to people, and it can be confidential and anonymous. So that's a great resource for people who are maybe taking that first step and aren't quite sure how to start. So 988 is a great starting point. But in addition to that, there's community mental health centers throughout our state. There's, of course, behavioral health facilities, substance use treatment centers. There's so many different resources, and it's hard to list all of those or to, you know, give all the specifics. So that's why it's great to reach out to either 988 or even the 211 resource number that covers our whole state.
If you or a loved one are struggling with suicidal thoughts or other mental health challenges, please reach out to 988 by call or text any time of the day. You can also contact 211, the state's helpline number. You are not alone. I'm SDPB's Jackson Dirks.
Again, that number is 988. You can find this story and all of Jackson Dirks' reporting online. Go to sdpb.org/news. Now let's take a moment to recognize that you've been hearing a lot about mental health so far this hour. It can be a tough topic. So coming up, we will bring you sounds for well-being. Sound therapist Veronica Ludwig is next. We will play you into the break with sounds of her chimes. We invite you to de-stress, recenter, and relax. You're in the moment on listener-supported SDPB. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. May is Mental Health Awareness Month. The theme this year is turning awareness into action. So let's consider one way to take action to lower stress, promote mental wellness, and elicit a deep relaxation response that also fits into our everyday lives. Sound. Veronica Ludwig uses singing bowls and crystal singing bowls in her mind-body healing and teaching practice. Walking into her studio is like walking into a soothing sound and aromatherapy bath. I asked her if there was something from her early years that drew her to the healing power of sound.
I can't say it came from my childhood, although listening to bell choirs, I would think, and church bells was probably that very first introduction to this idea of even sound being present in spiritual places or religious places. But the first time I specifically saw a singing bowl was when I lived in Hawaii, and there was a flyer for a singing bowl meditation, and I paid and showed up, and I thought it was the most fantastic thing I'd ever seen.
But what were you hoping from that first experience?
I really was going in with an open mind, but I did already have an exposure with Lakota ceremony, with this idea of how they absolutely are using singing, drums, vibrational tools in a healing capacity. And when I first saw singing bowls, it was definitely in that corner of being attached to a meditation. So those two things were being kind of offered hand in hand. So how do you use meditation and sound together to elicit an even deeper relaxation response within the body versus just meditation alone?
So how do you use singing bowls and sound in your practice today? Tell us a little bit about your practice and how you incorporate that.
Sure. So I have a full-time energy work, mind-body healing practice, and teaching practice. So I have been facilitating large group singing bowl meditations with a very large set of singing bowls that's designed very purposefully to clear the central nervous system, to rebalance the energy body through a systematic use of harmonics. But then I also use the singing bowls in my everyday healing practice when my clients come in. So I have a second set of singing bowls that I use, as well as gongs and chimes and other sound instruments, because they are so effective at just naturally rebalancing the central nervous system and creating that relaxation response in the body.
How did you learn?
So I actually went to formal school almost 25 years ago for body work and energy work. Initially, when I first started using sound instruments, I was actually self-taught because there were no trainings. This was advanced stuff. And so just through my own process of research, understanding harmonics is how I first developed the harmonic set that I use now. And then in later years, as trainings have come available, I have taken a few different sound trainings and sound certifications, you know, to fill out that knowledge base and that experiential perspective even further.
Help me understand something that you know now that you didn't know when you were first starting out, that you've either learned through, you know, additional study or new advances in the research from a, you know, medical journal, for example, or just from being in the room with people as you do the work.
I would say the biggest thing is that I had no idea that when you use singing bowls and sound properly, I had no idea the impact that it could have on like large groups of people. Initially, it was more for personal fascination, but the fact that you can use them therapeutically, I think that was relatively unheard of here. So I would say that was the biggest surprise, but also, you know, the biggest gem was when you understand how to use sound and vibration properly, it absolutely can elicit a healing response. And this is known, like that perfect fifth of a C and G creates the greatest cellular healing response in the body, and that they also use these in integrative cancer centers for exactly this reason.
So what kind of outcomes are you seeing?
You know, it really runs the gamut. You know, you get people who are coming who are just noticing that they are a lot more relaxed after singing bowl meditation. For instance, I used to go to Pier pretty regularly, and there was this farmer that used to come in who had arthritic feet. And so he used to joke with me that he didn't believe in any of this stuff, but the pain in his feet would be gone for about 30 days after I was there. And this is just a great example of energy accumulation in the body, which is what I specialize in. I look at the physical body much different. It's not solid. It's vibrating. A lot of what people experience as pain or tension or anxiety or stress are actually tension patterns in the body. And you can either come in for private sessions to help release that tension, or, you know, utilize these group meditations and utilize a sound wave or sound bath that's done in a very purposeful way that's designed to clear those patterns of tension, those patterns of stress, whether it's mental and or physical. But sometimes when you get those little healing miracles where somebody, you know, literally walks out the same day without a pain that's been bothering them for years, I understand that they had an area of energy congestion in their body or energy distension. They just know that they came, they rested on the floor, listened to some nice singing bowls, and then they feel fantastic when they leave.
So for that farmer or somebody else who comes in as a skeptic, but then walks out with, you know, a positive feeling in their physical body, what happened?
The way that I like to explain the energy body to people is that basically your body's a lot like a sponge, and it soaks up energy from all your thoughts, your feelings, your emotions, your daily environments, past injuries, past surgeries, and that your body is a vast network of energy channels, and that when there is disruption, it's a lot like having a kink in a hose, and you can have that energy build up on either side of that kink. So either a distension or a lack of energy flow, which you can experience as pain. And it's a lot like having a gas bubble. And everyone understands what like a gas bubble, an intestinal distension feels like. But what if you have one of those in a different area of your body that can't be accessed? Then you need something like a good energy healer, a good sound bowl practitioner, or a good acupuncturist, someone that can move that energy to reestablish correct energy flow and function in the body. And that's functionality, what I do, and all these different things I either practice in or teach, is that I'm restoring proper energy flow and function to the human body.
Do you work in conjunction with a physical therapist or a primary care physician if somebody is, you mentioned, you know, in a cancer center, an integrative cancer treatment, it's often used. How does this intersect with the medical care people might be getting in a traditional setting?
You know, I have quite a few people that, you know, self-refer, but I actually have quite a few patients whose therapists actually send them here for the kind of work that I do to help with PTSD and anxiety, relaxation, just fundamentally helping to reset the energy body from those type of things. I regularly have clients. I have clients right now that are receiving stress reduction care for stage 4 cancer diagnoses, cancer maintenance, all of these types of things. Augustana Integrative Nursing Program recently has been adding sound sessions, acupuncture, and teaching their students also about Reiki. Those are all things that I offer in my office and have been professionally practicing for, you know, well over 2 decades now.
So let's talk about that individual. Someone comes in here, they're going to explain to you what's going on, and then how are you designing a session, I guess, from a layperson's perspective to assist that person's individual needs?
Sure. I think it really depends on what they're coming in for. I have some people that are coming in just straight for energy work. Sometimes they're coming in for self-care. They just want that deep relaxation. They understand that this is part of their regular self-care, whether they're coming in for body work or energy balancing sessions. Then I might have someone else coming in, maybe in that same day, who's coming in after a stage 4 cancer diagnosis, and we're fundamentally clearing their energy body of a lot of that accumulated, negative, unwanted accumulated energy that's built up in their energy body, reestablishing correct energy flow in their cerebrospinal fluid. We might be combining a little craniosacral work to balance stress responses on those deep energy channels in the body, as well as using things like warm stones, the soothing sounds of the singing bowls, clearing the body that way. Then I've also had people that are coming in for more body work based sessions where we might be mixing some actual massage with something like craniosacral work and some of those physical manipulation tools of the cranial bones to rebalance the body based energetics, mixing it with the higher vibrational healing such as the Reiki, the channeling, to really flood that body with light to help it heal faster, which is, again, that's as far as Reiki's efficacy, that has so much evidence-based medical information on it that, you know, I taught it for Sanford, and they offer it through their volunteer program because it works so well at helping people heal faster after injury.
Do you have a favorite sound, a favorite tool, a favorite what have you, that you return to again and again that you just happen to like as well?
You know, I personally love the crystal singing bowls. The metal singing bowls are also wonderful, but I think my first love was with the crystal. And, you know, I think one of the things why I've always been so drawn to crystal, and this is where science, the physics, is actually proving the sacred sciences. But there's this great book out called The Field, and it's all the Einsteins of our day. It's all the physicists. But one of the things that was really fascinating about that book is that they were able to prove that our cells actually communicate to each other with light. A little known fact about crystal singing bowls is that they also give off light. So in addition to sound and frequency, they also give off light. And I think that when you're an energy sensitive person like I am, there's just something so fundamentally soothing and beautiful about not only the sound of the singing bowl, but when you understand that there's an invisible light wave going out too. And it's really magical. Singing bowl meditation is really for everyone. I think in this fast-paced world, we've kind of normalized stress and anxiety and overwork as being normal, all the way down, you know, to our children. And so this is really a useful tool that can be done and utilized and can benefit anyone, all the way down to the little ones.
Veronica Ludwig's home base is in Sioux Falls. We will put links up to her work on our website with information about her public events. She's also on Facebook at Bodyworks by Veronica. Teacher Talk is after the break. We have got our eyes on the end of the school year. We'll lay out some tips for closure after a short break. You're in the moment on Listener Supported SDPB. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Students, teachers, and school staff across the state are wrapping up their year this week. For today's Teacher Talk, we dive into what it means to say goodbye after sharing 9 months of growth, joy, struggles, and memories in the classroom. Gina Benz is in her 25th year of teaching. She teaches Teacher Pathway and AP English Language at Roosevelt High School in Sioux Falls. She's also on the adjunct faculty at several colleges and universities. Plus, she is a recipient of the prestigious Milken Educator Award. Dr. Jackie Wilbur is a faculty member and director of the Center for Student and Professional Services at the University of South Dakota School of Education. She began her career in public schools in 2007. She has served as a middle school and high school teacher and a public librarian. She's also an experienced registered yoga teacher through Yoga Alliance. Here's our conversation. This is one of the hardest parts of being a teacher. How come?
When people ask me about the hardest parts of being a teacher, it is on my very, very short list. Always having to say goodbye. Always having to say goodbye to people who mean a lot to you.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You fall in love with these kids again and again, and then they go.
They really matter. They really matter to me.
Yeah. And you spent 9 months?
9 months.
Learning about someone and understanding them, and they know you.
Yeah.
Students have a hard time saying goodbye, too. Not all of them.
Oh,
but
a
many,
lot do.
Many.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think a teacher can do her best to make it not awkward, because for the students, they're still learning how to navigate life. And
right.
So
right.
Let's model what closure looks like and how we can place value on the 9 months we just had together and say, this was good. It is over, but it was good.
Yeah. Jackie, for little kids, I remember those elementary school years where I almost felt like, you know, it was out of proportion with how much mm-hmm. some of the kids were just despondent about mm-hmm. like leaving their elementary school. But that's part of that's developmentally appropriate.
It is, right. My area is not elementary, so I'm sure there are many folks who have additional information about what the development is. But if you think about just the lifespan of a young person, they haven't gone through that much change yet because yeah. they're not old enough to. Mm-hmm. And so it feels new and fresh and challenging, right? All of the changes that are they're happening to them for the first time.
Yeah. How do you set your mindset correctly, Gina? You know, to say, hey, goodbye is an important part of what I am teaching right now.
I have to first come to terms myself with, you know, it's ended and this was special. And then I, after I've had my own time thinking about it, then I can share whatever I've decided to with my students to create closure. But some students, it's really hard because it's hard to navigate difficult emotions.
Yeah.
And so a lot of students actually will just try to sneak out and just avoid the emotions. And so one reason I like to do the closure is because I don't think we should escape and avoid our emotions. We should recognize what they are and honor them for what they are and what they have to teach us.
Yeah. All right. So moving on is necessary because a new group of students is coming into that classroom.
You know, once upon a time I would say, I will always be your teacher. Nope, that's not true. I will always be your former teacher.
Yeah.
And I can't continue to give you the same energy and time that I gave you this school year because I have a new bunch of students who need and deserve my energy and time. And so, yes, I have to let go of you. You have to let go of me and move on to the next person who will support you.
All right. So how do we set this up? What are some of the ways to prepare for the end of something?
I can only speak to what I do and what I've seen a few teachers do, but I think the possibilities are endless. I like to take a class picture. Mm. And not, you know, the formal class picture, especially that elementary teachers get and students get. But I take a class picture, maybe outside by a tree or something like that. And I also like to give them just my final words. And that's where we explicitly talk about, explicitly, maybe that's not the best word, but
directly
talk about the emotions that go with the end of something. And then I like to leave them with a final word. Of course, I'm an English teacher, so I'm all about poets. And there's a poem I really like, but also even just a favorite line from one of Walt Whitman's poems about how students best honor their teacher when they learn to destroy the teacher, which sounds terrible. And then the kids love that, right? It's so provocative.
Yeah.
But it means that they don't need me anymore.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You don't need me anymore.
Yeah.
And I like to send them off that way.
Oh, that's nice. Jackie, what would you add to that? Other ways that you think are fun to create rituals of closure or opportunities for processing those emotions?
I think the intentionality behind having some kind of ritual or ceremony or routine that gives the time and space to walk through closure is what's important. What you actually do, I think there are a variety of ways that can happen, but being intentional about it, doing it on purpose, taking time and space for it is really important. I went to an event last night here on campus at USD, and there were a group of students that were at an encouragement dinner, and each student had an opportunity to say something if they wanted to, words of encouragement to their fellow classmates about finishing up the end of the year. They shared memories of the course of the year and their time together. And so I think giving students an opportunity to say what having spent time together in this learning environment has meant to them, watching that ceremony was very, very powerful.
I love that. Giving the students an opportunity to express to each other what it was like to be in this space together. Wait, that's interesting.
Ooh,
yeah.
My rituals may be changing.
There's room to add that. I think that who was the teacher that we talked to who was the who came? Oh, I'm going to forget her name.
Rebecca Peterson.
Rebecca Peterson.
Oh, yes.
And when she, you know, I would listen to their story at the beginning of the year. Mm-hmm. Now I'm curious to know what she does at the end of the year.
Me too.
I am as well. Yeah. I will say that's one of my final assignments in almost any class I teach at any grade level I will have them write something at the beginning of the semester, kind of what they're anticipating, what they're thinking about the course ahead, and then have them look back on that first essay and then write a reflection and think about all that they've learned and overcome and gone through, because I think it's important that students reflect on their own growth. I know that that's something that I personally struggle with just as an individual, is to give myself credit where credit is due.
Yeah.
And so as part of my closing ritual as an actual assignment, I will have students write a reflection on their own growth over the course of the course.
I got to add that to my ritual. This is so good.
One of the things I did as a parent when it was the senior year of high school, I was like, I cannot have everything be the last.
Yes.
You know, this is your last homecoming. This is your last, you know, orchestra concert. Yes. Like, I can't do it. I will cry for 9 months. Mm-hmm. I'm just not emotionally equipped. So we called it a victory lap. So going into senior year, we're like, this whole year is a victory lap.
Yeah.
And we're going to look at everything as that's your victory lap. And just that simple reframe was a way for me as a parent to sit in the space and say, you know, you got to this final concert and it's as good as it is because of all the other concerts that we, you know, and it was also a way to acknowledge that knowledge and, you know, practice and skill build on each other. Mm-hmm. And like, you know how to do homecoming now, you know how to do the first week of school, you know how to do, you know, this standardized test or whatever. And it was, I mean, I was in high school that you'd like, you know, burn your notes or whatever. It'd be like, I'll never have to. And I was, of course, not the kind of student who would ever burn my notes because I wanted to keep them, you know, forever, because I'm just kind of a note saver by nature. And so the victory lap was a good reframe. And I truly enjoyed every day of my daughter's senior year.
Mm. Oh, I love that reframe. And it makes me think about graduation then.
Yeah, right.
Which is ultimate closure.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it's designed for.
Yeah. So then should there be graduations for preschool, kindergarten, fifth grade? Like, what are some of the other, because I think sometimes we try to fit, you know, because we don't have a good way to close out something, you know, it's a graduation and let's put little kids in caps and gowns. and that might work for a lot of people and it might be really, really special, but there might be other ways to do that as well.
Yeah, and I think you don't want to make something become cliche, if you will. And so just recognizing that there's a lot of ways to create closure beyond a graduation ceremony.
Yeah. Are there other things that you mentioned too, Gina, helping them prepare for the next thing? In your case, it might be their senior year because they might be juniors. Mm-hmm. And getting them to think about what kind of senior they want to be.
Yeah.
Tell me about that.
Yeah, I think it could work for any grade level probably, but especially my juniors as they become seniors. I say, you know, I've been teaching a while and I see seniors come into our school two different ways when they start their senior year. Some walk in looking to be served. They're the upperclassmen. They're the ones with the most experience. Mm. Serve me. And others walk in looking to serve because they want to leave a legacy. And I guess in both cases you leave a legacy, but in the second case they leave a legacy of service, of joy, of commitment, a good legacy.
Yeah. Hmm. Gina, any other gifts? Do you give gifts? Do you accept gifts? What are some of the meaningful ways to close out a year by giving and exchanging something?
You know, I don't give gifts. Middle school and high school teachers have 120, 140 students. Yeah. That can get to be quite a bit. So I don't see a lot of secondary teachers doing that. However, if they do, something small is always appreciated, I'm sure.
Yeah, bookmark.
Or that picture you took of the class, a copy of the picture. Elementary teachers, again, you know, they don't have to spend a lot of money for this, although I've seen some have little notebooks they give the students, a special pencil.
Yeah.
You know, again, it doesn't have to be huge. Maybe a plant that they all grew together, little plants.
Yeah.
Whatever it is, a remembrance is nice and does not need to cost money at all.
Yeah. What else, Jackie? Anything else on this concept of closure? How long? I ask you a question, then I'm going to make a more specific question, but you can broaden it if you want. How long does it take for the teacher to sort of have, because your closure's not done. You're still at work when they leave. Now there's packing things up and there's grading.
Cleaning up your classroom and grading and all of that.
What is closure like for a classroom teacher?
Oh, that's a great question. I mean, as I always say to you, Lori, it depends. But yeah. On the kind of teacher that's you life. Are and yeah. as is life, yes. But I, obviously not being a classroom teacher anymore, it's different for me now in a university setting. But when I was in the middle school and high school classroom, I appreciated those days after the students had left where just the teachers and the staff members were still in the building and everyone could kind of dress more casually and the posters were coming down and the lockers had been cleaned out and you were grading and catching up with the teachers around the hall. I like that part of the year, and it always helped me feel excited for the summertime too, which is a great part of being an educator.
Yeah.
How might some of this apply to people in other jobs? You're getting promoted. You're leaving one job for the other. You're getting divorced. Your student is going off to college. What are some of the things that we need to pause and consider during times of transition that we can maybe learn from the classroom?
Transitions take time. Mm-hmm. I think that's one of the things that new teachers learn right away is at least I do in working with students who are pre-service teachers and going into the field, you might think, oh, I'm going to have them stop doing this one activity and start doing this other activity, and that'll take a minute. It's going to take more than a minute. Mm-hmm. Transitions take time.
Yeah.
And so I think that applies to all of life's transitions, that it's not the same as just turning a page in a book. It takes time to go from one thing to the next. And so just honoring that you need that time and allowing for it and planning for it will make the transition much easier.
I always felt we needed 2 weeks to really figure out how to transition from school to summer.
Oh, yes. Oh.
And I would always try to short-circuit it. If I made a better plan, we would make the transition more quickly, and we would jump into summer right away, and we would be doing fun things. And no matter how much I planned, how great I thought it was like it's just going to be sort of emotionally unstable. Not in an outlandish way, but just, you know, things you would notice for 2 weeks. And after 2 weeks, we all settled into the new routine.
Yeah, that's how I am. My sleeping, I have to get to a new sleep schedule.
Yeah.
I get to a new sleep schedule. Yeah. New routines, absolutely. Mm. I'm going to also say that with transitions, with closure, sometimes it's just you. The other person in the relationship isn't going to be a part of the closure, doesn't want to be part of the closure.
Yeah.
And this can be in the classroom. It can be, like you said, in an office, in a personal relationship. And so sometimes the closure is just you. For me personally, a lot of writing helps me with that. Or talking with friends, talking through the closure I want. And then, like Jackie said, just some time.
Give it time.
Give it time.
Mm-hmm. You can find this episode and more of SDPB's Teacher Talk. It's a podcast that celebrates teachers and education. Find SDPB's Teacher Talk on your favorite podcast platform. Find the companion blogs on our website, sdpb.org/teachertalk. And that is our show for today. We hope that it served you. In the Moment is produced by Ari Youngerman and Ellen Kester. I'm Lori Walsh from all of us here at SDPB. Thank you for listening.